From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, on this Day Without Immigrants, Michigan farmers talk about migrant workers.
The jobs my guys do, they're not taking them from anybody because there's nobody that would do it. I don't care if you're growing pickles or whatever. Nobody here is going to pick pickles.
Just allow them to get a visa. Allow them to come out of the woodwork. Allow them to not live in fear. Allow them to contribute to our economy.
A new state law ensures home birth midwives are licensed.
We notice that there's a lot of places in rural and urban areas where there isn't a lot of access to good maternity care. And with this license, we're hoping to grow the CPM credential so that more midwives can come and provide that.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. A new law recently signed by Governor Snyder means home birth midwives in our state will need to be licensed. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we look at what's in the new law and what it means for women who want to give birth at home. But first, apples and immigration documents, soybeans and border walls. Today is a day without immigrants, and a number of Michigan farms are quieter than normal today. Businesses of all kinds are closed around the country as immigrants stayed home from work and school in response to President Trump's immigration policies. This day without immigrants reaches not just factories or restaurants, but Michigan's farms where migrant and undocumented workers make up a large percentage of the workforce. Rob Steffens is here with us now. He owns Steffens Orchard in Sparta in Kent County. And Denny Heffron owns Heffron Farms in Ionia County. It's good to have you both with us today. Rob, I want to start with you. Tell us a little about your farm.
Well, I'm an apple grower primarily, and we've raised apples. I'm a fourth generation.
Okay, fourth generation farming here in Michigan. And Denny, what about Heffron Farms?
Well, Heffron Farms also is a fourth generation. It's cash crop grains, corn, soybeans, wheat, and cattle.
So this day without immigrants, what has it meant at Steffens Orchards, Rob?
Well, the people that work for me have called me last night and actually asked me, told me what was happening, and they wanted to take the day off in support of what is happening today, in support of the immigrants, to kind of show how important they are to United States, and in particular here in Michigan. So I didn't have a problem with it.
So were these migrant workers who had called you?
Yes.
Okay.
They worked for me for a number of years, but they wanted to support the immigrants that have that come up here and work for us.
Denny, what about you at Heffron Farms?
Well, our help did not show up to work today. And I think this is the first time ever that they didn't show up for work. So I guess that's how important it was to them. These people, is all they want to do is work. They don't want to be harassed. They just want to work. They don't want to cause trouble or anything. And they're scared to death right now because of the immigration stuff that's going on. And it can go on into, you know, some of my help has children that were born in this country that are legal citizens here, and they're just scared to death. That's how simple it was, and we fully understand. And but it gave us a taste of a day without them, which is not good.
It's not good because, and I think it's something that we have to make the point that Michigan agriculture depends on these migrant workers, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and that's one of the, you know, the best things about these people is they always show up to work. They work great. They're just great employees to have, and we count on them very, very much. You know, we have non-migrating help here too, and I'm going to tell you what, the migrating help is much better help than our local help. That's the only way to put it, and by far the better help.
Yeah. Wow. What do you want to say? How do you want to add to that, Rob?
Well, I agreed totally with Denny. You know, our people, they're just so hardworking, and they are here all the time, every day. And, you know, they just want to contribute. They want to be, they don't want to be harassed. There is a fear. They've lived in fear for a while. You can't get a driver's license in Michigan if you're an undocumented person. And there's quite a population in Michigan and people that need to migrate up here to work that fall into that category.
You know, you're making such a point to all of us that these migrating workers have such a key role in the entire supply chain, whether it's the growing and the harvesting of the food to selling that food in shops and restaurants. It's that they're part of all of that. I've got to wonder, what have your thoughts been as you've watched the president push his immigration agenda over the past just 3+ weeks since he was sworn in? Rob, I'll let you start with that.
Well, you know, is he doing anything different than what the Obama administration had done? You know, I'm not in support of anybody who is committing a crime or has committed felonies. So I guess I don't have a problem with that part of it. But there's a population that is hardworking and it follows the laws, that wants to follow the laws and is in fear. And that's a population that I'm concerned with.
Well, we have to make the point. We never heard President Obama say that there will be a big, beautiful wall to keep people out.
Yeah, I personally don't think that's going to work at all. So I think we just need some immigration reform. I think it would be very simple, actually. And I think that would take care of a lot.
Danny Heffern, what have your thoughts been as you've watched, especially these last 3 weeks?
Well, I guess is what I would say is Washington has underestimated these people. They value coming here to work so greatly. I don't think you can build a wall tall enough or deep enough in the ground to keep them out, first of all. You know, the next thing is these people pay in all the taxes. We take out taxes, everything just like we do with anybody else, and they're not eligible for any of that. It's just heartening to know that, you know, we've got people, and they're not taking jobs. You know, there's some things you hear about people that say, oh, they're taking jobs. I'm here to tell you right now, the jobs my guys do, they're not taking them from anybody because there's nobody that would do it. I don't care if you're growing pickles or whatever. Nobody here is going to pick pickles. You know, picking apples, all of that stuff, taking care of cattle. You just cannot find anybody local that can do that. And these people have such a desire in that because this is land of opportunity. And we are so lucky. You know, they had one day here that they didn't show up to work. You know what? We're going to get over that really easy. But I'll tell you what, I've said all along, if they would all just stay home for 1 week, it will just about cripple us. They are such a part of the workforce and so dependent upon that it would not take very long, and it isn't just agriculture that would cripple. You can go into any industry, and it's the same story. The contractors, the landscape people, the restaurants, the hotels, all of that, we're all in the same boat. We cannot find good, reliable help local. And without this, it's going to cripple us. This country, agriculture, we export a third of what we grow in this country. And without those people, I can tell you right now, it won't be there to export. They play such a role. And it's really sad that we have such a population in this country that won't work.
You know, there's a chunk of people in America who support what President Trump wants to do, who say, hey, they broke the rules. They didn't follow the rules to come into this country.
Well,
what do you say to that?
We don't have any rules for coming into this country. And that's the biggest problem that we have no way to track them when they're in this country. It just don't make any sense.
Both of your counties, Kent and Ionia, both went for Donald Trump in this past election. I'm just kind of curious, what did your conversations with your neighbors, how did those go leading up to the election?
Well, there was a lot of talk about this because of the immigration and that. And first of all, I don't think he can do it. I don't think he can build a wall high enough or deep enough to keep him out. So if he thinks that's the answer, I just disagree that that is going to work. And it's going to cost somebody a lot of money to try.
What do you think, Rob?
Well, as far as the conversations that went on, I think there's mixed emotions amongst people I know. So I have people that voted for Trump, I have people that voted for Hillary. So I don't think it really matters. But to be honest with you, we do need to have some immigration reform. I think it's very simple to do. You know, if you want to track these people and you want these people to come out, you know, give them a visa. So they can work, to be able to go back to their homeland to see their families, and then be able to come back and work. I think that'd be an easy fix. I think those people would want to come out and you could identify it, that this population that's in the United States, I think it's really a simple fix. That'd be my answer to something like that. But you have to give them a visa, a work visa, without a fear of putting them in jail or shipping them back, because a lot of them have been here many, many years, you know, some 15, 20 years. And like Jenny said, have families that are not, that have kids here that are American citizens. So is, do you want to send them back? You're taking the breadwinner away from that family, or the mother, or separating those families. Just allow them to get a visa. Allow them to come out of the woodwork. Allow them to not live in fear. Allow them to contribute to our economy.
Denny, you were very, very clear what the impact would be on your business if migrant workers can't get to you or if they are sent home. You were very clear about that. What do you want to add to what Rob has said? What do you think that the answer is for you and for these workers?
Well, I agree with Rob. You know, somehow we have to give them a way in, a way that we can identify them, that we can track them, and we know who's here, and you know, and all of that. One other thing I also wanted to add, we have ones that are here legally with visas, and they can't get a driver's license. They're legally here, can't get a driver's license. They have, I know one of my workers has not seen his mother in 9 years. He would love to go back and see his mother. He is scared to death he would never be able to get back in here.
The Farmer's View of This Day Without Immigrants. We've been talking with Rob Steffens of Steffens Orchards in Kent County and Denny Heffron, who owns Heffron Farms in Ionia County. Gentlemen, thank you to both of you for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Still to come, a review of Contrary Motion, Andy Mozina's first novel. Critic Kelly Forden says he's a rare combination, both a literary writer and a really funny one. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Epiphanies.
Heart of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
You've heard that old saying, there's nothing new under the sun. That might seem like a strange concept for the next ideas Jeff DeGraff to embrace, but he believes today's innovations are built on the foundation of yesterday's ideas. He's been examining a decades-old debate for clues about how to move ideas forward in a country divided over the very meaning of the word fact.
30 years ago, University of Chicago professor Alan Bloom published The Closing of the American Mind. The book deconstructed higher education's failure to prepare students with the knowledge necessary to lead enlightened lives. Bloom's emphasis on reading the great books was met with adulation by conservatives, who viewed it as a declaration of traditional values, and with condemnation by progressives, who thought the work was a perpetuation of social class inequities. What started as a discussion about what every educated person should know ended in a contentious debate about the virtues of meritocracy versus democracy, as if the two ideas were mutually exclusive. When I was a junior professor, I was certain that Dr. Bloom was just another misguided old classicist. These days, however, I'm beginning to wonder if he may have been right all along. In any age, ideas are assembled, disassembled, and reassembled according to their usefulness and whoever has the power to move them. For example, what the founding fathers considered inclusive would now exclude over half of our current population. So over time, ideas get updated, like versions of a computer program. Each version is an extension or a complete reimagining of the previous one. Innovation is built upon ideas of every hue, old, new, strange, obscure. They never seem to fit, but with time and a little luck, these ideas may actually hold up while the rest of our world shifts and shakes. Professor Bloom cautioned that cultural relativism would have us mistake the teetering edges for the unmoved middle. He saw Plato, Marx, and Freud as the compulsory bedrock upon which more advanced ideas could be balanced by an independent mind. What I think Dr. Bloom was getting at is that it's not about political doublespeak, spin doctors, or fake news. It is about the closing of the American mind. We no longer collectively possess the ideas, the range of lenses, or the apparatus to think clearly, freely, and independently. The constructive conflict of the classroom debate was replaced by safe spaces and trigger warnings. And with it went the courage to confront the mediocrity of second-rate ideas. Ironically, this has left us without the ability to rightly judge fact from fiction. Bloom predicted that there would come a day when many Americans saw the truth as relative. That day is here. We have always had people who use ideas to swindle and deceive. But there have also been those among us who are not so easily fooled. They think deeply. They connect the dots. They recognize the patterns. But it's becoming increasingly difficult to see these people and even harder to hear them. So let's start looking for the next idea by asking a few questions to those who actually know about the last idea. Where have we seen an idea like this before? When has this idea been tested? How will this idea actually work? Who's proposing this idea? Why are they trying to advance this idea? What are some alternatives to this idea? Like Professor Bloom, I too believe that great ideas, like people, are works in progress. Perhaps the first step to uniting our divided nation is to reestablish a common ground. It may be that we need to retrace some of our past, to revisit the great thinkers, before we can reopen our minds and recommit ourselves to finding a way forward together.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea. You'll find his essay at the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A new law recently signed by Governor Snyder means home birth midwives in our state will need to be licensed. Let's look at this law and just what it means for women who want to give birth at home. Nicole White is a CPM, Certified Professional Midwife. She's with Midwives Alliance North America. Great to have you here, Nicole.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And Emily Dove Meadows is a Certified Nurse Midwife, a CNM. And we will sort out all of these alphabets together as we figure out what is in this new law. And good to have you with us, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
So let us get a greater understanding of your profession of midwifery so we can understand the law. So, Nicole, you are a Certified Professional Midwife, CPM, which means what?
It means that we work in the home birth setting or a birth center setting. Our education is all about working around birth and postpartum and prenatal. So we aren't nurses. We also, our scope of practice is just in the childbearing year. So we work with families up until 6 weeks, and we're experts in normal, uncomplicated pregnancy, birth, and postpartum.
And then, Emily, as a certified nurse midwife, how does that compare and contrast with what Nicole does?
So certified nurse midwives not only take care of women during the childbearing year, pregnancy, postpartum, intrapartum care, we also take care of the gynecologic needs of women from adolescence through menopause and beyond menopause. So family planning, annual exams, pap smears, we can order your mammograms, we can send you for, you know, other types of screenings that we don't do, other types of exams that that we don't do. But we are essentially primary care providers for women for through the entire lifespan.
And you are registered nurses who have gone on to do a master's
right
in midwifery.
That's
and
right.
passed the certification examination.
Yep.
And where would you be at? Would you be part of a medical practice? Would you be in a hospital? Where would you actually practice?
So certified nurse midwives practice in hospital settings, in offices, in clinics, in big medical practices, in small medical practices. We are also licensed, you know, through our national organization. We are able to provide births at home as well. There are a small number of certified nurse midwives in Michigan who do home birth or birth outside of the hospital. However, the majority of nurse midwives in Michigan do take care of women within a hospital or kind of institutional setting, whether it be a clinic or within a hospital framework.
So how does what you do differ from the nurse, the RN on the OB floor?
So as the midwife, you are taking care of the woman from the first time that she comes into the clinic. Really, we're outpatient providers when we're working as, you know, on the unit. So we come in, we see women in our offices. And then when they go into labor, we or a member of our team will be with the woman in the hospital as she goes through her birth. So a registered nurse is part of that care team. There's, you know, there can be a physician on that team. There are registered nurses. There are people in the operating room. There's a whole host of people. But as the certified nurse midwife, we are the provider from the time she walks into that outpatient first OB appointment. You go and you meet your person and you learn about your pregnancy. You get information throughout the entire pregnancy. And for a woman who is low risk, we take care of low risk women. So we're not taking care of women with multiple medical conditions. We leave that to the physicians who are very good at taking care of those high risk women. For a low risk woman, we can see that person throughout the entire pregnancy. They might not ever need to see a physician.
So circling back then, as we look at what you do, Nicole, how does that differ from what Emily does?
Well, it's similar in a lot of ways, and I do think that midwives, regardless of setting, are the answer to our maternal and infant mortality crisis that we have, not only in the United States, but worldwide. So more midwives all over. We do all of our work out of the hospital, so we don't interface too much in the hospital setting other than when we need to have a consultation. So this is for very healthy women that want to have a baby in their home.
At home. So let's talk about the differences, the main differences between midwifery care and obstetrical care when it comes to childbirth. I don't know who wants to kind of tackle that one.
I think that midwives do a great job of keeping families healthy, women and babies healthy. They come into us healthy, and we do our best to keep them that way. We do a lot of education. We do a lot of community-based outreach. I think that obstetrics is necessary, but they tend to be working with women that have more complications, and we're the ones that get lucky to have the healthy, uncomplicated births.
I'm guessing that there is a greater chance for both of you as midwives to develop that kind of personal, ongoing relationship with people. Oh, I see heads nodding. I think I hit on something here.
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of women midwives work in lots of different types of practices. But when you're in a smaller practice, you do have that opportunity to really build a relationship one-on-one. If you happen to be the person that that person sees throughout their pregnancy, they come in and they see you for every visit. And then, you know, if you're in a shared practice, you happen to be the one who's on call when they come in for their birth. It's just, I mean, it's a very intense and very emotional and very kind of supportive and loving environment it can be. So that's really, I think, can be one of the kind of secret ingredients of midwifery care that I know I find to be really rewarding and special. And I know that a lot of the women and families that we take care of feel the same way.
Yes, we forge incredible connections, and we also allow the patients to be the people that are making a lot of the decisions. You know, we really work with informed consent and families.
So this new law focuses on the CPMs, the Certified Professional Midwives, and you were both involved with reviewing and the process of crafting this legislation. So what does this legislation do?
Well, we are the 31st state to have a license for the CPM credential, and it allows the CPM to be licensed so that we can interface with the medical community a little bit more streamlined. So then when there are transfers, that they can happen smoother and with more continuity.
So when you're saying transfer, somebody's at home and perhaps something comes up and that person needs to get to a hospital.
Yes.
You can do the handoff in a cleaner, easier way.
Exactly. We come in as a licensed provider. They understand we can give them the documents of, you know, the prenatal care that the client has gotten and also what has happened in labor. And the licensing also just provides more access. I think as we look across the U.S., across Michigan, we notice that there's a lot of places in rural and urban areas where there isn't a lot of access to good maternity care. And with this license, we're hoping to grow the CPM credential so that more midwives can come and provide that.
And what does it mean for the midwives now? What has to happen in order to be now licensed in the eyes of the state of Michigan?
Well, you have to have the CPM credential, and then you have to basically pay a little bit of money. So basically, you have to show that you are a CPM, and if you're not a MEEC accredited, then you have to get the bridge certificate and pay a small fee.
I think we need to understand is, what does this mean for women who want to have home births in Michigan?
I think that having more midwives will help with the access and being able to, as time goes on, be reimbursed because right now insurance, because we're unlicensed providers, insurance doesn't cover. And with in the Affordable Health Care Act, as a CPM, it is listed as being able to be reimbursed at a licensed birth center.
I think most people understand there is no such thing as a risk-free birth. What does the research show us about hospital birth versus home birth? Because isn't it true big trouble can happen very, very suddenly where things seem to be going well during a delivery and then suddenly it's not? And I guess I'm wondering, is that laboring woman at greater risk of being at home if trouble strikes versus being in a hospital?
Well, I mean, I think trouble can strike in any setting. Just because you're in a hospital doesn't mean that that nothing can go wrong.
But you're close to an operating room.
Absolutely.
Or resources that you wouldn't be if you were an ambulance drive away from.
Right. And one of the things that we do as midwives is midwives even providing care in a hospital room, mm-hmm. in a home, anywhere. One of the things that we are trained to do is to assess risk and assess situations so we know if something is leading towards a situation. Mm-hmm. Our job is to be able to recognize issues that come up, have a discussion with the women and families that we work with about how they want to address it, remembering that the woman herself has choices about where she wants to have her birth, and that we support those choices. However, we are kind of gatekeepers, and we hold the safety of the women and the children that we are working with. So, we will work quickly if we need to, just as we do in the hospital, if we feel that we need to get into a situation with more intervention.
And I would say a majority of transports happen for first-time moms that are tired and need some extra help, need maybe that pain medicine or an IV. A lot of times, since we're working with healthy women to begin with, we can see a complication happening ahead of time, a vast majority of the time. And as Emily said, we are doing diagnostics the whole time. We're listening to the baby. We're making sure mother and baby are great and healthy.
Is it fair to say hospitals and insurance companies are not supportive of home birth?
I would say that a majority are not. And I think as more research comes, they will look to changing that.
Well, I mean, as far as hospitals go, I think that this bill is a really great opportunity for even for midwives who are working in the hospital to encourage our organizations to help allow the safe transfer of women into our organizations. If we are going to see an increase in home birth, if that happens, all of the hospitals that we, there might not be any midwives working there, but our goal is safety and health of the women and children that are involved in the families. So whatever we can do to facilitate those transfers, there's an opportunity with this new bill for all of us to improve those outcomes and to facilitate that transfer of care.
Is that kind of lack of support of home birth, is it a business decision or is it a difference of philosophy?
I think it's both.
I do too.
I think it's a lack of understanding.
I think midwifery is kind of misunderstood or not widely understood, which is why having an opportunity to talk about it today is great. Mm-hmm. I think people have a preconceived notion of what a midwife is or what we do or what we don't do. But, there is an opportunity here for, to increase the access. That's one of the reasons why certified nurse midwives were wanting to support this bill, because we do want increased access for women and for them to choose.
And I'm so excited to be able to provide more access of care to families in Michigan and to have this license to move forward, because I really believe more midwives is the better.
Nicole White is a certified professional midwife, and Emily Dove Meadows is a certified nurse midwife. And it was great to talk about midwifery with both of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for your time.
Up next, hospital birth or home birth? A mother of five shares the pros and cons.
I definitely enjoyed that 24-hour honeymoon away from my other children before they came in asking me for things. So with most of my births, they came home from school asking for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich about, 2 hours after I gave birth. So that...
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. We have just discussed the profession of midwifery. Now let's get ourselves a firsthand take on the difference between hospital births and home births. Danielle Atkinson is the proud mom of five children. The last three were born at home. Danielle, let's go through these births, kind of compare and contrast, if you will. Baby number one was in a hospital. What was that like?
It was not bad, but it wasn't ideal. There were a lot of protocols that we had to follow. I was a hypnobirthing mom. I am a hypnobirthing mom. So you have to be kind of in a respite state and a quiet environment. And there were a lot of questions being asked of me. I think I was asked my address about 5 times while in labor. And so those things kind of took away from the experience that I was trying to have. But baby was healthy and everything went okay.
So when you say hypnobirthing, it's because you're kind of in a state of hypnosis?
Yeah, relaxation techniques and stuff. Mm-hmm.
And I do know that there are all those protocols to keep people safe.
Yes.
Tell me your name, tell me your date of birth, all of that. So that kind of seemed to be at odds a little bit with what you were trying to create.
Yeah, exactly.
But it all went well. Mm-hmm. All right. Then for baby number 2, you moved to the alternative birth care unit at Providence Hospital in Southfield. Why'd you make that move?
It was, you know, they offered a really quiet environment. They didn't have to follow those protocols. They kind of had all your information ahead of time, and they were just kind of set up for a more relaxed setting. So
not just the environment, but the process. Was that different?
Yes, it was. So when I got admitted into the hospital, as soon as you get on the unit, the nurses are just very open to whatever kind of experience you want to have. So they tell you there's a tub and they kind of leave you alone, or they check on you depending on what you would like. There's just, you know, a nice warm shower there that you can get in and get out of. I know in my hospital birth, they really didn't want me to be in the bathroom when I was in active labor. They were more open to that at the birthing center. And, you know, I still have a relationship with the nurses and the midwives. So it was just really a really nice experience at Providence.
Yeah, it sounds like you like that. But then you took the step with baby number 3. You took that big step of choosing to give birth at home. What went into that decision?
There were quite a few reasons, but the prominent reason was that I didn't have insurance at the time. So Providence was really out of reach for me. That experience that I really appreciated and enjoyed wasn't something that I could afford at the time. So the people that I knew through Providence were some doulas and some home birthing midwives. And we just had like nice conversations about what a home birth would mean. And since I had 2 really great experiences with no complications, I felt comfortable making that leap.
So you felt like your birth history had indicated that things could go well.
Yeah.
But, and we know trouble can happen very quickly in obstetrics. How did you process weighing the risks of not being in a hospital if trouble should happen?
Yeah. I mean, my mother actually was born at home as well, and she was a midwife. Even though she tends to a medical kind of lens on things now, really knowing the history of my family, knowing that 13 of my aunts and uncles were born at home, that my mom was in that field, I felt really comfortable. And also my home birthing midwife had a lot of births under her belt. So we just had a lot of conversations. It really wasn't a decision that I was prepared to make until really when I had the baby. At any point, you know, I told my midwife, you know, if I don't feel comfortable, I still might want to go to Beaumont, which was basically across the street from my house. It's really not that far. And she was open to that. She's like, that's completely okay, but know that we've got this under control. And she answered and anticipated every question I had with like the perfect answer. So I was like, well, what about, I just read about hip dysplasia, or I, you know, what if my water breaks, you know, and it's been 2 days, you know, and she had an answer for everything. And I felt really comfortable with her experience and the fact that Beaumont was right across the street and I had an EMT who lives 3 doors down. So
you felt like, all right, I've got some safety nets.
Yeah.
What was the feeling of going through the labor and delivering your baby in your own home?
It was wonderful. My mom was able to be at every birth with me, but, you know, when we saw the first signs of labor, we were able to prepare my bed and my mom was helping me and get everything ready and know that, like, the room that I was going to have a baby was the room that I was going to be able to stay in, and I wouldn't have to rush or worry about being discharged or anything, or worry about when my children could come and see the babies. And so it was really great to just be in my own space.
Well, we know that choice of when and how to have a baby, it's a very, very personal decision, and home birth isn't for everyone. But now you can offer us the perspective of having had babies in a hospital and at home. So when you talk to people, what do you tell them about that experience, starting with what you see as the pros?
Yeah, it's funny because most people, when you say you had a home birth, they are immediately saying, oh, I would have done that if. And so, you know, you want to tell people it's not for everybody. I understand there's a lot of, we very much medicalize the experience of birth. So I understand people's reservations. But, you know, I simply say it was really great for me and it was great to have the choice. And I think people really understand and appreciate choice and options when you're in the most intimate and vulnerable position you are probably in your life, you know, definitely at that point in your life.
Amen.
So people understand that and appreciate that. And the fact that I've had three now, I think that opens people up more to be like, okay, well, maybe this is something that is okay and an option. I think there's also this preconceived notion that it's for like the super wealthy and only certain people can afford it. Midwives charge very little. It actually costs us less to have our children at home than it did all the fees associated with having a baby at the birthing center. So it was really affordable. We were supporting women that were there for us throughout. I still have a relationship with my home birthing midwives. And it's just another opportunity to explore what you can do and how you want to do it and know that this is an option for you and your family.
Would there be any cons that you could think of? Anything that
cons.
You didn't think was so
yes.
great?
What? Yes, there's definitely cons. Well, I mean, there isn't the option to have an epidural. So you have to know that going in, like, you're at least going to have to wait to get to a hospital, get painkillers. And then there is not having the time away from your older children, which is a pro and a con. I definitely enjoyed that, like, 24-hour honeymoon away from my other children before they came in asking me for things. So with most of my births, it was they came home from school asking for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich about, you know, 2 hours after I gave birth. So that... That's about it.
That's where grandma jumps in.
Yeah.
What did your husband think of it?
He was a little nervous the first time. He was concerned. And I told him that, you know, we definitely have the option of going to the hospital anytime. And then I think our midwife really reassured him as well. And he was nervous up until that baby was delivered. And then with the two other ones, I think he was thinking more on that first experience that went well.
Two in the hospital, three at home. And it sounds like if there were to be a number six, would you go for home?
There will not be a number six. But yes,
if that
will not happened, I would have that baby at home.
Danielle Atkinson, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you.
His empire was built on pizza. And with last week's death of Mike Ilitch, his empire is now in the hands of his son, Christopher. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. And from pizza to the Tigers and Red Wings and reshaping the look of downtown Detroit, Mike Ilitch built quite a lot from that first little pizza shop in Garden City, didn't he?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I think if you look at he's the last of a great generation of sports owners in this town to pass from the scene. William Clay Ford, the owner of the Lions, died a few years ago. Bill Davidson, the owner of the Pistons. But I don't think any of them have had the impact on the city of Detroit and really their hometown. And truly, Detroit was Mike Ilitch's hometown, like Mike Ilitch. He bet on Detroit long before it was fashionable and it was cool. In fact, a lot of people thought he was out of his mind when he moved his headquarters down to the Fox Theater that he spent a lot of money renovating.
I remember that so well in 1988 and seeing what that renovation was all about. And you stop and you think, now, how much annual revenue and how many people are employed by Ilitch Holdings?
$3.3 billion, roughly, and about 21,000 employees. And that's all of their businesses. So that would be the sports teams, the pizza, the entertainment, the development company. They've got about 10 or 11 different businesses that are part of Ilitch Holdings. And Chris actually has been the CEO. I think there's this misnomer that all of a sudden he's being elevated. He's not really being elevated at all. I mean, he's been the CEO of the company since 2004. I mean, that's 13 years. And over that period of time, his father, I think, was giving him more and more responsibility, and he was getting more involved, even in the last 4 years, more involved in the sports teams themselves and some of the big decisions there. I think if you look at the big District Detroit development that's rising at the corner of Woodward and I-75, that really is a lot of Chris, and there's a lot of Chris in that as that planning has been coming along. He's been deeply involved in it, and the parents have been less involved. I mean, you know, Mike Ilitch was 87 years old when he died, and his wife, I believe, is somewhere like 83. Chris said in a recent radio interview that his parents don't come into the office every day, and I don't know why we would expect that they would. They've been working really hard for a very long time.
But it sounds like it was a well-planned succession with this gradual ramping up through the years. As you say, since 2004, when Chris Ilitch became CEO.
Yeah, and they came out in May, this past May, and basically reaffirmed Chris's position and also affirmed that all of the assets within the Illich Holdings would remain family owned. So any speculation that upon Mr. I's passing that, for example, the Tigers would be up for sale or the Red Wings would be up for sale, I think they pretty much made it very clear that that's not going to happen. I mean, it's amazing. The Red Wings, I think he bought them in 1982 for about $7 or $8 or $9 million. And it's what now, a $1 billion franchise?
It's amazing to think of talk about return on investment, really, with both teams. When you think about what Christopher Illich brings to the table, and you talk to business associates and civic leaders, so what does he bring and what do you think he will do the same or differently from his father?
He's kind of quiet. He's very thoughtful. You talk to people that have both worked for him and also business leaders who've been on executive committees with him, like a Business Leaders for Michigan or other things. They all say pretty much the same thing, that he's very thoughtful. He's very diligent. He's not somebody who shoots from the hip. A very different style than, say, Dan Gilbert, who will be very public, is known to pop off on social media and do things. Chris is not like that. He's not wired like that at all. But he does share some of the traits of his father. One person told me, they say he's really good at marketing, really good at pushing for something that's really unique. This is a guy who spent a lot of years studying what his parents did, to the point where he eventually came up with something he calls the secrets to the sauce, which my understanding was actually a speech that he developed that he wanted to give publicly. And he went to his parents and he said, I want you to read this. This is what I've observed. And tell me if you think I've observed this right. And, oh, by the way, I would like to give this speech. They looked at it, the story goes, and they said, you know what? You're right. Go ahead, give the speech. And he's done this in radio interviews. He's given the speech and talking about it and what he's learned from his parents, perseverance, hard work, commitment, humility with success, be innovative, be creative. I think that's the way he's going to try to continue to lead, because I think he knows that that has what has been successful for the Illich family and the Illich empire.
And success or failure to meet the challenges that lie ahead for Illich Holdings means a lot to the city of Detroit and Southeast Michigan.
Oh, huge. They were very much a leader. You know, Dan Gilbert has said in published interviews about Mike Illich that what Mike did had a lot of influence on what Dan ultimately decided to do. And I think if you had to run it back, and I think in one thing I quoted Dan at the beginning of the week, you know, what he did 30 years ago really set the course. And had he not done that, had he not, as Gilbert said, lit the fire, things might have been very different for the city of Detroit.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Writer Kelly Forden first became aware of Andy Mozina in 2014 when he published a short story collection titled Quality Snacks. Mozina, she says, is a rare combination, both a literary writer and a really funny one. Quality Snacks was laugh-out-loud funny, she remembers. So naturally, Kelly Forden couldn't wait to get her hands on Mozina's first novel, Contrary Motion. As part of our ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark, Kelly Forden has this review.
Contrary Motion tells an unlikely story. The story of, to paraphrase a bit from the opening, a 6'1", cube-headed, block-shouldered, average white male with no vowels in his last name who fell in love with the harp. The main character, Matt, has loved playing the harp since middle school, and his ultimate dream is to make first chair in an orchestra. To say it's not going well for Matt is to put it mildly. He's been pursuing that goal for 24 years with no luck. When we meet him, his father has just died, his wife has left him, his best friend from college is a well-known, extremely handsome actor living in the West Village, and on top of all that, or perhaps because of all that, poor Matt is suffering from penile erectile dysfunction. How could it get any worse? It gets worse. Because Matt, though only a midlifer, can't take Viagra because of his low blood pressure and dizzy spells. His doctor says that if he takes it, he's liable to pass out. Perhaps his doctor says he should consider talk therapy instead. His new girlfriend, Cynthia, is patient with his performance issues, but she does start to wonder whether her harpist boyfriend might secretly prefer men. Are these concerns things we might once have coded feminine? Well, yes. And Mozina was apparently aware that he was upending gender stereotypes when he was working on the book. This is the first time in fiction I've ever encountered a close-up, long-term battle with penile erectile dysfunction, and boy, was I glad to see it. I mean that in all seriousness. A man filled with insecurities about his body, his performance, his place in the world, and willing to kvetch about it? Bring it on. He even wonders, gasp, whether the fact that he can't perform might mean he's still in love with his first wife. He's neurotic and conflicted. He's a man willing to equate sex with love. This is unusual territory and utterly refreshing. Let's face it, on every front, Matt, the protagonist, is having a rough go. He signs on to play the harp for people at the end stage of life in a hospice and then quips, "You know things are bad when you find yourself looking to dying people for some kind of lift." All of the pathos in Contrary Motion is punctuated with oodles of humor, and Mozina accomplishes a rare feat of allowing his character to dabble in self-deprecation without tumbling down the rabbit hole into clownish deflection. The question of how Matt is going to conquer all of his myriad neuroses is a captivating one, and Mozina delves deep into Matt's psyche in order to transcend these limitations. There were moments in the novel when I wondered whether Matt was ever going to be able to extract himself from the sinkhole of his life, because he appeared to be so fixedly his own worst enemy. But Mozina has not fashioned a one-dimensional character here, and what I enjoyed most about this novel was the constant surprise of Matt's insights. It was really fun to come along for the ride.
Kelly Forden is a poet and fiction writer. Her collection of linked stories, Garden for the Blind, was a Midwest Book Award finalist and a 2015 Michigan Notable Book. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.